Welcome to the Interior Design Podcast. I'm Hayley Roy. I'm a commercial interior designer and I have a passion for creating functional, beautiful spaces. Over the years, I've had the pleasure of working on a variety of projects and I've accumulated a lot of knowledge to share. To create this podcast for you, a lot of the episodes I've teamed up with my good friend, interior designer and architectural designer, Cheryl Sutton. Cheryl and I are very different and often have opposing views, which makes for some interesting discussion. But it also provides you with two sides of many topics we cover. This episode, however, I'm riding solo with the amazing Jo Burley from Solus Ceramics, who has come into the studio to talk everything tiles. We're planning to do a little extra video today to show you some products, so watch out on YouTube for that one too. I started this podcast because I feel strongly about interior design and the importance of educating designers. A lot of what you hear from us, you won't learn on a course. As designers, there's so much we need to know to do our jobs well, and we want to give you a forum where you can access the information you need wherever you are. Whether you're an aspiring designer, someone designing your own home, or a seasoned professional working in residential or commercial design, this podcast is here to help you improve and thrive. We're not about ego-stroking interviews with big names. Instead, we focus on practical advice that you can apply directly to your work. You'll learn about different products, their applications, and sustainability practices. Our goal is to equip you with the knowledge you need to excel in your projects. And remember, if it's not fun, we're not doing it. So expect a bit of humour, a few swear words, and the occasional innuendo. Now, a quick note on production. We are interior designers and not sound producers. I am handling the editing myself, so please be patient with any technical glitches that happen. I am improving my production skills as the podcast progresses, and I appreciate your understanding. If there are any editors out there who'd like to volunteer their skills, in return for a mention, though, please feel free to reach out to me. Thank you for tuning into the Interior Design Podcast. Let's do this. Hello, Jo.
Hi, Hayley.
Welcome to the Interior Design Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me here.
It's so nice to have you on the sofa. We've got a new sofa.
We're very really excited.
We are now on YouTube as well, so you can check us out on YouTube if you're listening on audio. So today we're talking about tiles, everything you need to know about tiles. Jo came into our studio a while ago and
a couple of years ago,
and I just love Jo. She's amazing. She's so knowledgeable and she taught me so much about things that I've been doing this for a long time and she was teaching me stuff. So thank you for doing that, Jo. And thank you for coming on today. It's lovely to have you here.
You're very welcome.
So tell us about you. What's your journey at Solus?
Shall I start from the very beginning?
Yes.
Okay. So when I left school with a few A-levels and I wasn't very academic, I just kind of fell into being a secretary because I didn't know what else to do. And I was an awful secretary and I hated it. And then I moved to London and I found this tiny marble masonry working under the arches in Vauxhall, where everyone was just relaxed and everyone is enjoying what they were doing. And they needed someone in the office, but I could go to work in jeans and it was just a lot.
That's always good.
Exactly. And then I just kind of fell into reactive sales. So if anyone walked in off the street, which didn't happen very often because it was in the railway arches in Vauxhall, I just kind of looked after them and it sort of grew from there. One of our customers there was Domus Tiles, who are one of the biggest tile specification suppliers in the country. They were a customer and they poached me to go and work with them. So I spent just over 5 years working at Domus. And then there were lots of kind of changes within the company and I felt like I wanted to move on and try something different. And I ended up at Solus doing exactly the same thing I did at Domus. And now I'm at Solus. Solus was a tiny company when I joined. There were only 18 members of staff. And the head office is based up in Birmingham and it was a really small family-run business. But it was just a really nice, warm environment, really friendly people. They made me feel really welcome. And it's worked, touch wood. I've been there for just over 20 years. We've grown from 18 people to over 100. We've gone from 2 million a year turnover to 22 million a year.
Oh my God. It must have changed so much.
It has, but we're still family run. We're a second generation family run business. So it's still got that small family environment feeling where everyone knows everyone. So, you know, if I need to speak to the guy in the sample department or the one of the warehouse guys or someone in accounts, everyone knows everyone. And it's a nice, friendly environment.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Must be a nice place to work if you've been there 20 years.
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't have stayed if they were horrible, but they're lovely.
Aw, it's cool. Joe, what are you going to educate us about today?
So one of the nicest things about working in a small company is you get to see everything. So although we have a marketing department and a fantastic creative director, we still, as sales reps, get to go to the tile fairs and see what's new, what's coming up, what the trends are around the world. So the largest tile fair, well, technically the largest tile fair is Coverings over in America, but we don't go that far. We go to Europe. So in Italy, in next week, I'm off to Italy for the massive Chesai tile fair. It's like Olympia on steroids. It's enormous. They have their own land train. It's just huge. So we get to meet up with all the factories that we work with, and there are hundreds of them, see what's new, pick the best bits, and then bring them back to you. So over the next 3 or 4 months, we'll be able to show you all the new exciting things that are coming out of Europe.
Wow, that's amazing.
It's a great trip. It's incredibly hard work. I mean, last year when I went, I was walking 40,000 steps a day for 4 days. But it is the best way to lose weight.
If you want to lose weight, go to an exhibition. Yeah,
just walk it off. Yeah, and then drink lots of Prosecco all night long because it's Italy.
Well, that's always good. Italy's lovely. What part of Italy is it?
It's in Bologna.
Oh, nice.
This is, yeah, beautiful.
Good wine in Bologna.
Yeah, great food. It's where the Parmesan cheese and the balsamic vinegar come. It's just gorgeous. Yeah.
Amazing. That's so cool. Do you find some people who do traveling as a job find it quite monotonous? Is that something that you feel like, or is it, you know, you don't do it that often, so it's more exciting?
I don't do it often enough. Definitely. Sometimes we get the opportunity to take architects and designers to factories to see how tiles are being made, and we'll try and see a few different factories, and that is great fun. But yeah, I don't do that often enough. And then we've got Chesai and Sevisama, which is the Spanish version, in May. So we've got a couple of trips a year.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. So you get away and you enjoy it.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I really love traveling as well. And I had a job when I was younger, though, and I was traveling to Asia like 4 or 5 times a year, and I was just permanently jet lagged. Then it was like, it got really, I think I did about 10 years doing that, and it got really difficult in the end because I was just like, oh, no, I'm going to jet lag again.
That's a really long flight. At least it's a couple of hours.
Yeah. If you're in Europe, it's lovely, isn't it? So let's talk about tiles. So what are the basics about types of tiles that are available in the industry?
If you split up man-made tiles from more natural things, so your limestones, marbles, terracottas, natural stones, and just stick with tiles, generally you've got two types: porcelain tiles and ceramic tiles.
Mm-hmm.
Porcelain tiles are much harder. They're fired at higher temperatures, so they're frostproof and stainproof and indestructible. They're man-made granite that's produced in a couple of hours rather than a couple of millennia. But they're as tough as nails and they will last forever. So they're an incredibly durable, inert, sustainable product that will outlive all of us. Ceramic tiles aren't quite as strong. Basically, they're a glaze that's man-made on top of a clay biscuit base. They're fired at kind of 800-900 degrees, so they're not quite as strong. They're a little bit easier to work with. So, for example, if you were doing lots of wall tiling but needed to put in lots of holes for power points or shower heads or whatever, it's easier to work with a ceramic tile and cut holes in it than it is to work with a porcelain tile. Having said that, the tiling contractors these days are very experienced with both, so you shouldn't really ever have an issue with cutting holes in tiles. But yeah, porcelain tiles definitely stronger. Generally, porcelain tiles are bigger. So ceramic tiles, you can go up to 300 by 600, 300 by 900 probably, but not much bigger than that. Porcelain tiles, the largest you can get is 1.6 by 3.2 meters. So we can go from really small to huge. Generally, when you get over about 1200 mil square, tiles, they'll change the way they make them. So smaller format tiles, they grind up all the aggregates, the pigments, the powders, the feldspar, sand, and everything they're going to put into it. It's like a cake recipe. They grind them up into a really fine powder, press them into a mold, pop them out and fire them. When they get to the really large formats, they roll them out like a giant sheet of pasta. So they just keep rolling. Someone made a 7 meter long tile once just to see if they could. But for practical purposes, you stopped at 3.2 meters because that's what fits in a lorry. Mm. But they tend to be thinner. So you'll be 6 mil for a rolled out thin tile as opposed to 9 or 10 for a normal tile, which means a third less raw materials, third less weight in transport, less energy required to heat them, to fire them.
So they're more sustainable.
Yeah. They tend to be more expensive though.
But they're more durable, so they'll last longer.
Well, all porcelain tiles are incredibly durable. I mean, they still dig up Roman mosaics that give them a clean and they look like they were laid yesterday kind of thing. They will outlive all of us. They'll last forever.
So there's other types of tiles, isn't there? Glass, stone and encaustic. Encaustic, is that how you say it?
Yes. Yeah, so you've got all the natural stones, your marbles, slates, limestones, which obviously, not my forte, but you know, they are real stones. They have their own unique characteristics and beauty and quality. Which we try to copy with porcelain, always the same. I don't know, limestones and marbles are quite porous in comparison. Granite is incredibly hard and durable. Slate, the way it's made, is made in sedimentary layers, so it can fracture and split. So it's a bit more fragile. Terracotta is basically like ceramic tiles before someone stuck a glaze on them, but they're very traditional. You need to seal them.
Are they more porous, terracotta?
They are, yes, yeah. Then you've got quarry tiles, which are similar but fired at a slightly higher temperature, so not as porous, but those are the things that have been around for the longest. Mm. You know, thousands of years people have been using these hard surfaces, you know, taking mud out of the ground and baking it to make it hard, or digging marble or granite out of the ground and using that. Then you get onto things like encaustic tiles, which are cement-based tiles, and they tend to come from sort of Spain and Morocco and lovely, gorgeous, warm locations. They build frameworks and put metal pieces into the frameworks and pour different coloured cements in to make beautiful patterns. And
wow.
They're lovely, but they are cement based, so they stain and you have to seal them and look after them, and they can be an absolute pain to deal with. And then we've sort of moved on to man-made porcelain tiles and ceramic tiles in the last couple of hundred years. And technologies improve them all the time. So yeah, you started taking mud out of the ground and baking it and using it as hard surfaces, and then they started glazing them, and then that's kind of evolved into porcelain tiles, which are just the most practical hard surface because you don't need to seal them, you don't need to look after them too much. They'll never produce VOCs or nasty chemicals. So from my point of view, makes them really easy to sell.
Yeah, so that was going to be one of my questions actually. What's the most sustainable? Is it porcelain?
Yeah. Yeah.
So in what way is it sustainable?
Probably is. I mean, there are some porcelain ranges which include some recycled content. It's always a very tricky and grey area when people at the factories give us their recycled content, whether it's actually post-consumer recycled content, pre-consumer recycled content, which is a bit of an oxymoron. But yeah, there are some ranges that will include glass or old ceramics. But generally, the most sustainable part of a tile is its longevity. The fact that, yeah, it's all inert and it will last forever. Briam officially classed tiles as lasting for 60 years.
Porcelain
tiles.
Porcelain, and not ceramic.
Actually, both, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We tend to use more porcelain on the floors because they're the same colour all the way through, hopefully, or similar colour all the way through. And if you're unlucky enough to chip a ceramic tile, it's going to be a different colour underneath the glaze. So porcelain's a bit more durable and hard wearing. So, but yeah, Briam say they last for 60 years in a project, but in reality, they'll last for 6,000 years probably.
Can you help us understand the difference between wall tiles, floor tiles, and outdoor tiles?
I can try.
I'm sure you know.
Anything that goes on the floor can go on the wall, so long as the wall's strong enough to take the weight, but not the other way around. So you do get some wall tiles that are normally ceramic that are just for ceramic wall, just for walls. Glass, for example, mostly just for walls. There are some toughened glass ranges you can use on floors and in swimming pools and things like that. The problem is there's just so many tiles that that you can normally find something for any location. The biggest issue is always slip resistance. So you obviously don't need that for the walls, but for the floors, we always like to know what areas you're tiling to make sure you've got the right slip resistance for that area. if it's a domestic project, you can put down anything you like anywhere, but we'll always advise you not to put smooth tiles outside, for example, because if you've got standing water, you can slip over. Should I mention things like slip ratings, R ratings and pendulum tape?
Definitely, definitely.
So the European slip ratings are the R ratings, if you're wearing shoe, between R9 and R13. R9s and 10s are normally your smooth tiles that you would use inside. And R11s and R12s have a texture to them, and you'd use them outside or in wet areas. R13, you'll never need, ever. In 20-something...
I didn't know they did R13.
Exactly. But in over 20 years of selling tiles, I've used it once, and it was in a fish gutting factory. Exactly.
You need it in a fish gutting factory.
Do you get to do lots of interesting jobs.
Oh, wow.
Basically, 9s and 10s inside, 11s and 12s outside. So the R11s and R12s have a structure to them, which will stop you skidding in wet areas and ice, or they're dirty. Now we have the pendulum test, which we've had for 7, 8, 9.
Is that PTV, isn't it?
Yeah,
PTV.
The PTV values, yeah. So again, they're measured for barefoot or shod foot areas, in the same way that the R ratings are. So with the R ratings, you've got R9 to R12, anywhere where you're wearing shoes. And the barefoot version, which is tested in the same way, is A, B or C. Then you've got the pendulum test, either barefoot or shod foot. And it's just a rating between 0 and 150. And pendulum is a portable machine, which makes it handy if you ever need to take one to site. It's a friction test. So an arm kind of swings over a tile, a rubber stopper on the end of the arm, hits about 8 to 10 centimetres of tile, and it's the friction that slows it down, and it gives you a number at the end. So anything over 36, so 36 to 150, is classed as a low risk of slipping surface. But there are no rules that say what goes where.
And you said there's a shod foot and...
Barefoot.
Barefoot.
Yeah.
So what's the difference?
So
obviously barefoot is barefoot.
Yeah. So if you're tiling a kitchen or a...
Oh, shod. Shod as in shoes.
Yeah, got it.
Yeah.
And then you need different results if you're in the bottom of a shower or around a swimming pool barefoot. And like I say, every job is different. So we will need to know who the client is, if it's open to the public, if you're... floors are flat or slopey, how many people you expect to go through buildings, if you're, you know, inside, outside, where you're tiling, things like that. Because every project is a bit different. But from my point of view, I've got hundreds of years doing this, so I should always be able to help you if anyone has any questions.
So I always struggle with this because... So I know I generally will over-specify because I'm kind of being cautious. So I always go like R11 if I can. In a toilet, but you don't need that, do you? You only need R10.
Exactly. Yeah.
In a commercial toilet.
Yes. If you put an R11 down, because you've got the structure, it's going to be harder to clean. And if you're walking on dirt rather than on tiles, it's going to be slippery. Even if it's structured, if it's covered in a layer of dirt, it will be slippery if it gets wet. So more slippery. Yeah. So you don't want to overspecify.
Okay. Like, do you know what I mean? This is why I'm doing the podcast, because I just don't know everything. And I know I don't know everything, and I can't possibly know everything.
You can't possibly know.
And I think the best thing for me is whenever I am specifying, I just call the people that I know. So I've been able to call you over a few projects and go, I'm doing this, and this one's okay, right? and I think that's what's important to do, is just to check with the supplier to make sure, look, I'm putting this in here. Is this going to be all right?
No matter if you've spent 6 months on an interior design course or 7 years training to be an architect, both of you will have to deal with so many different things in your job. You have to choose lighting and soft furnishings and hard finishes and deal with electrics and heating and ventilation. You've got so many different things that you have to deal with. If you have a question, speak to someone who has one thing to deal with.
Yeah, and I remember because I came from a background of commercial furniture fit out, and we used to do a small part of interior design as part of our pitch to sell furniture. And I worked with a lot of interior designers, and I always remember kind of going, well, that I used to go back to people quite a lot and go, well, that's not going to work, because someone had drawn something, and I remember someone did something for Glen Eagles Hotel that we made, and we went back to the designer and said, I know you've spent a lot of time making these drawings, but this is going to be really uncomfortable. And I always remember thinking, when I started the business, I decided that I was always going to collaborate. because nobody knows the product better than the people who are making it. And I think that's really important for designers to remember as well. And I think a lot of people kind of go, right, I've got to know everything. You can't possibly know everything. So, you know, rely on the people that do know and work with them. So just to summarize, the wall tiles, floor tiles, outside tiles are ratings and PTV 36 ratings. Yeah. R9 is the lowest R number.
Yeah.
And that one is for
internal dry areas that aren't open to the public.
R10.
Slightly more texture, still going to be smooth for internal dry areas that are open to the public.
R11.
Going to start having a bit more structure. So wet areas, external areas, potentially pool surrounds, although you'd need the...
It's like a shower.
...to go with it. Bottom of a shower. Absolutely.
R11.
Yeah. Yeah. Anywhere where you've got standing water.
R12.
Basically the same as R11. It's just a bit more structured.
And R13 is for fish
gutting
factories. There we go.
Nowhere, don't use...
You probably can use it in places like abattoirs and things like that. I bet they do stuff like that.
Yeah, canning factories maybe, where feed production if they've got...
Yeah, I'm sure there's people, architects who are specifying things like that.
Specialise in these interesting areas, yes.
I don't think the fish gutting factory is going to invite me to come in and interior design.
No, possibly.
But I would love that. I'd love to do the toilets. There's some really cool fish wallpaper. Brand McKenzie do an amazing one, which is like a really good toilet wallpaper. And I'm waiting to do a fish restaurant. I'm like, if there's any fish restaurants out there, please, please get in touch with me because I would love to interior design your toilets. Just saying. Putting it out to the universe.
Do you want me to talk a bit about how tiles are made and
interventions? I'd love that.
Yeah. So we've obviously talked about tiles are made, spraying all the raw ingredients into molds or rolling them out in giant sheets. But a lot of the factories now are becoming a bit more sustainably minded and a bit more eco-focused. We work with one factory who are B Corp certified, which is great.
Mm. Can you explain what B Corp certified means?
I can try.
Sorry.
And B Corp is kind of a holistic approach to generally being a really nice company. So it doesn't just look at what you make or how you make it or where you buy your raw ingredients from. It looks at whether you recycle your rubbish, how you produce your energy, how many women or older people you employ, what you do for your local community. So one of the largest Italian factories that we work with is a company called Florim in Italy. They have an enormous facility over in Italy. They have a great big auditorium in the middle of their building for exhibitions and things like that.
But wow.
They give that space over to local schools and universities to use. They provide buses so their staff can get to work without having to drive. They produce all their own electricity, obviously, because they've got photovoltaic panels on the roofs, and the roofs are massive. And any excess energy, they give to the local community. So it's things like that that tick B Corp boxes. And there's something ridiculous, like 140 different boxes you've got to try and tick to achieve B Corp status. So very few people have got it. We've got two tile manufacturers that we work with who have B Corp.
There must be big companies. They're big companies, aren't they?
It's actually weirdly easier for a small company to become B Corp than it is for a big company.
Why?
You have less involvement with outside resources and other things going on. So if it was you and
more
you
control.
If you did something like a mini wind turbine or photovoltaic panels to make your own energy and you had some recycling bins, it would probably be easier for you to get B Corp.
I just assumed that it would be like the big corporations that would have the time to be able to do the exercise.
Well, yeah, there is definitely time involved in doing the exercise. But yeah, when you have thousands of employees, it's it's a bit harder to...
Interesting.
Minute boxes.
So the previous episode that we had on the Interior Design Podcast with Hannah Temple on about regenerative interior design, we were talking about all of this and sort of how do you know? Like, how do you know if it's a good product to specify? Like, there's so many things. So B Corp sounds like it's a good regulation to be following. It sounds like that sort of thing will probably grow.
Yes. And there is a European equivalent called EMAS, which is, EcoVadis. There's so many certifications. EcoVadis is a European holistic approach to looking at companies as a whole.
Mm.
So a lot of our factories have EcoVadis as well. But we also speak to them all about whether they've got ISO certification. So ISO,
would cover sustainability as well, would it?
ISO is more to do with internal processes within companies.
I thought it was a quality thing. Yeah. Is it more quality? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, quality control. I sell tiles, Hayley.
I know, but I'm a geek. I just want to know everything.
I'm trying.
What I'll do is put some show notes in of these companies that we're talking about, the ISO and the B Corp, and just make sure that there's a link in there.
But the big one these days is EPDs.
EPDs?
Yeah. So what's EPD that? Is the Environmental Product Declaration. It's basically an identity card for whatever you're buying, whether it's a carpet or a table or a light fitting or a tile. Anyone that produces a product that you can buy should be able to give you an EPD. It's an independently assessed certification. So an independent assessor has to go to a factory or a group of factories. There are three different levels of EPD, which I'll tell you about. And independently assess that company to trace where their raw materials are coming from and the carbon footprint of the production and transport of those raw materials. And in our case, you know, where the raw materials are dug up from and shipped to the factory, the carbon footprint involved in firing our tiles. Then there's a section on the carbon footprint for getting those tiles from the factory to the site, which is always a bit of a difficult one. Sites move all over the place. And then there will be a carbon footprint for installing that product. So if it's a table, carbon footprint will be zero because there's no installation carbon produced. If it's a tile, you've got adhesive and grouts, and those things have carbon footprints.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the other side of it where cleaning and maintenance and ongoing looking after of a product that will also have a carbon footprint. So carpet has a higher carbon footprint for its ongoing life than a tile does, because you need to steam clean or use chemicals or detergents to clean products.
Electricity.
And electricity, exactly.
If you've got a Hoover.
Tiles are
obviously assuming everyone has got a Hoover.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And also the afterlife of a product. So when you've taken your carpet up, whether it's recycled, whether it's burnt, what carbon footprint of that would be, what you do with your tiles. Most tiles end up as aggregate and hardcore, because when you take them up, they bring half the floor and the adhesive and with them, and you can't separate that out, so they end up coming hardcore. So there is an afterlife, but there's not a cradle to cradle. There are two
for any tiles.
There are two companies in the world who have cradle to cradle certification.
Wow.
And it is not possible at the moment. No one has the facilities to clean off those tiles and send them all the way back to Italy. I mean, the carbon footprint involved in that is pointless. So they are crushed up and used for aggregate. And 93% of all tiles that come out of building sites are reused as hardcore. So they do have an afterlife. They won't go into the ground. They won't leach anything. They won't produce VOCs or anything like that, but they'll go on and do something. Carpet, obviously, 75% of carpet that's taken up is burnt for fuel, which is not nice.
Yes, there's so much. I kind of talk about this a lot. I want there to be a regulation that I can just everyone has to do by 2027 or something or whatever. Well, that everyone has to be there, and it's really difficult to specify.
To Parliament in 2022, requiring contractors and architects to design and build to minimum carbon footprints. But it was stalled in Parliament at the second reading last year because the government were worried that if they made it law, which they all want to and should do and would be sensible to do, but they were worried that if they made it law, it would put building costs up. But then government did not want to start putting any costs up for anyone. So it all got stalled in Parliament and nothing's happening with it.
Yeah, I think that's the trouble, isn't it? No one can bite the bullet and be the bad guy on it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Jo, you're so knowledgeable. I love all the things that you know. It's great.
Thank you.
So in terms of supply chain, how does that work with what you do? So you work for Solus Ceramics.
I do, yes.
And you stock in the UK?
Not a huge amount. The interesting thing about working at Solus is we work in all sorts of different sectors. So there'll be corporate clients that we stock tiles for and bits and pieces that we keep in stock in the UK. But generally, everything comes into order. So it takes about 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
We work with 250 factories, something ridiculous like that.
Wow.
Almost all of them are based in Central Europe. So to ship their tiles from there to us, we go over with lorries, fill them up to the brim, and then drive them back. So normally it takes about 2 weeks. August, the factories tend to shut down.
Mm-hmm. All of Europe shuts down except the UK, doesn't it?
Yes.
So we need a holiday in Europe.
Longer, then.
Hint, hint, government.
Yes, that would be lovely.
I feel like I'm talking to the government. They're not probably not
They're
listening.
They're not listening to us. We actually now have two factories that we work with who are based in the UK producing products, tiles in the UK, which is just lovely. So we work with a quarry tile manufacturer who's based in the West Midlands, about 10 miles from our head office, who produce beautiful quarry tiles. And now we work with a Manchester-based terrazzo manufacturer who are making a range of terrazzo tiles.
Ooh,
for
terrazzo is really,
it's beautiful.
Really on trend at the moment, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
I did read somewhere the other day that terrazzo is on the way out already.
Really?
So yeah.
So you just come back.
I know, right?
Yeah. It's lovely. The nicest thing about the ones we have made in Manchester is that they try to source their raw materials locally.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got English limestones. Scotland produce marbles, which I didn't know, but you can get marble from Scotland. Oh. Wales, obviously, for slate. They also team up with the guys in the West Midlands at the quarry tile manufacturers and take broken quarry tiles and can put them in. But we can also take building waste from building sites. So old glass, old bricks, old marble that's coming out of a building site instead of going into landfill or being used as hardcore, we can take it, clean it, and put it into terrazzo tiles that can then go back to site when
it's ready. That's a bit cool. That's a reason to use terrazzo, isn't it? Because it's...
Yeah.
And is you, all terrazzo, are all terrazzo tiles recycled?
No.
Like that?
No. Originally, back in Roman times probably, they mixed the cement that they were building with broken marble chips. So it was a way of using leftovers and offcuts and broken stuff. And then as with all things, when it becomes popular, you have to start breaking the marble to make them all terrazzo.
Mm.
There's always going to be a certain amount of breakages and offcuts that end up in the terrazzo tiles. So there is a recycled content, but those original marble chips that end up in the terrazzo tiles weren't necessarily used before. So they would be pre-consumer, not post-consumer recycled content. At least now, yeah, we've got the ability to put actual recycled content into tiles. So basically anything inert, you can put nuts and bolts and screws in. We've done a project where they put marbles in the tiles and then polish them up and they look.
You're talking about terrazzo tiles. So you're not talking about porcelain or ceramic. These are terrazzo. Actual terrazzo.
Terrazzo made with cement.
So how's it made?
Okay, so literally it's like a cake mix. They mix cement and water and aggregate, whatever it is that's going into it, mix it all together. So all those chips would go all the way through. They're not just on the surface. Put it into molds and cure it. So with making porcelain or ceramic, it's the firing process. So the majority of the carbon footprint is in the fossil fuels used to fire the tiles. With cement, most of the carbon footprint is in the production of the cement. And then once they've made the tiles, they're just left to cure.
To just dry out.
It's a chemical process. And I am not a chemist. They cure. Let's leave it at that.
They cure with chemicals.
Yeah, it takes a few weeks for them to cure properly. And you don't want to ship terrazzo tiles when they're still wet because they can warp. So always terrazzo tiles will be on a 10 to 12 week lead time, even if it's made in the UK.
Do they not make it in sheets and stock it or anything?
Some do. Normally they're made in blocks. Ooh. Like natural stone is quarried in big cubes. They make terrazzo in blocks and then cut them so that...
A bit like a slice of bread.
Yes. Yeah, but that way you can have a 20 mil thick or a 30 mil or a 50 mil and it's all cut to order. And then you can... cut your sheets into 30 by
30. It's like having lots of cakes, isn't it?
Yes.
Lots of cakes that you're just sitting in there and then you cut it when you want to take one off.
Don't talk about cake.
Oh, do you want some cake? We should have got cake.
Always.
For our podcast.
Yeah.
Next time.
Tea and biscuits.
Yeah. Why didn't we get cake?
I'm so sorry.
So how are porcelain tiles made? You said about fire. Porcelain and ceramic made in the same way?
They're all still fired in big long kilns. It's just that a ceramic tile is... basically just clay. It's not fired at such high temperatures and then it's glazed over the top. With porcelain tiles, they grind the raw materials up into really fine powder and sort of press it into molds or roll it out into sheets. Sometimes they're the same color all the way through, whether they're kind of stony looking or plain colors. Sometimes they're glazed and printed on the surface, but it's glazed in porcelain on porcelain, so it won't wear off. But all your marble veins and wood effects and metallic effects, they're all a print surface glaze that's gone on top of a tile and then it's fired.
How thick is that glaze then? Is it really, really?
It's really thin.
Thin, yeah.
Yeah, really thin. So if you hit it with a hammer and you're unlucky enough to chip the surface, ideally you want, on a glazed porcelain tile, you want the body of the tile to be as similar in colour to what's going on the surface,
mm,
so that you wouldn't really notice it. But hitting and breaking a porcelain tile is really hard. They're really dense.
Mm.
It's easier to break a ceramic tile.
So in terms of what's the composition, so ceramic and porcelain tiles are made in the same way, but just from different materials.
Yes. Yeah. So ceramic is obviously more traditional and less ingredients go into it. With porcelain, they've been tweaked and refined over the years.
To make it better.
To make it stronger. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've got feldspar, you've got sand, got different pigments. You've got porcelain.
So it's basically ceramic is like the old fashioned way of doing it. And porcelain is like the evolved.
Yeah, it's a bit more, yeah, a bit more advanced.
Mm.
Definitely.
Oh, that's interesting.
But don't tell the ceramic manufacturers that. Because they definitely do produce beautiful, lovely things.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's easier to get patterns and pictures and things. Like if you want designed tiles, like drawings or pictures or stuff printed onto tiles, then we'll print them onto a ceramic tile because it's easier to do.
Okay. Is it easier to print onto ceramic than porcelain? Because porcelain's harder and has to cure?
No, it doesn't have to cure.
Be fired?
They would both have to be fired. Mm. Honestly, because printing onto tiles has been around for so long, you know, you can imagine all the Moroccan blues and whites and all the pictures and stuff. Everyone's been putting pictures and designs onto tiles for a long time.
Mm.
And traditionally, they've always gone onto ceramic tiles. So although I could get a porcelain tile manufacturer to produce a bespoke tile, they just want thousands and thousands of square metres to bother to retool and do it. Whereas ceramic manufacturers, because that's what they do all day, every day, it's much easier to tweak a production line and throw in a few bespoke tiles.
Mm.
And you can make smaller quantities quicker.
Mm. Oh, okay, that's interesting. How do you choose the right tile for different spaces, like bathrooms, kitchens, living areas, commercial? What's your advice on that?
First, we have to split it up between whether it's residential or commercial and whether it's walls or floors. So if you're doing a residential project, you can, in theory, use anything you like. I mean, when I moved into my house, we had polished shiny tiles on the bathroom floor, which are incredibly slippery and you'd never recommend it. But if it's your own home, you really can do whatever you like. As designers or suppliers, it's our job to recommend not to put shiny tiles around swimming pools or in the bottom of a shower. But honestly, for residential, there are no rules. For commercial, we will need to know if it's open to the public. So you have to have that magic PTV plus 36. It really comes down to slip resistance and aesthetics and design, so, you know, how you want it to look, how your client wants it to look. And then it comes down to people like me finding the right slip resistance for the certain areas that you're tiling. So it always used to be that male and female toilets, floors, for example, could be an R9, but disabled had to be an R10. I think that probably still says that in the R rating rules, but they're ancient. And now we obviously have the PTV rules as well. So if it's open to the public, we just say R10 plus 36 because it's the safest thing for everything internal and dry.
I love that you do R and PTV. Some people do R and some people do PTV.
Okay, legally, you have to have the PTV ratings open to the public. Yeah, if someone slips over in a shopping centre floor and you can't say it's an R10, it should be fine. You have to have the PTV rating legally. But the PTV rating has no rules as to what goes where.
Is that legally in the UK?
Yeah.
Because is that in Europe
only,
as well?
No, only the UK.
Okay, and what about the US? Do you know anything about that?
The US use the ASTM standard, or the turtle test. Which is it's a little machine that moves over the tile or the wood or whatever your surface is. And it measures resistance. It's got little pins inside that measure resistance.
Mm.
And it's called the turtle test. Tortoise test. Because the shape of the machine, I think.
Cool.
It's the ASTM test. And because the American market is huge, all the European manufacturers, they'll test the R rating and they'll test the ASTM and give you certificates. Because the British market is quite small, we tend to do all our pendulum testing in the UK.
Mm.
That way we can also guarantee that it's done properly. So when you pendulum test a tile, you have to pendulum test it horizontally, vertically and diagonally 8 times each way, in the wet and in the dry. And when you do, no one slips over in the dry, so you don't really ever need the dry pendulum test results. But the barefoot or the shod foot wet result is what you need. Every single time you swing the pendulum, you are then supposed to get it wet again. And we have found that some of the European factories didn't quite realise that. So as the pendulum got drier, their results got better. So we do all of our pendulum testing in-house. I know how to pendulum test, but I'm not allowed to. Our pendulum testers are certified. They go away every year and get their training assessed. The machines are sent away every year and recalibrated. So it's a legal requirement that we do not mess it up.
Is that just for tiles? Is that all flooring? Because I'm sure I had a conversation with someone the other day and they said, we haven't got the pendulum test, only the R.
Well, the R ratings have been around forever. And when you get your products, they come with the R ratings. Yeah. The factories do them. If you imagine a range of tiles that has 10 or 8 colours, every single time they produce them, they'll always be the same R rating. Every batch of every colour of every tile ever produced will have a different pendulum test rating result. So if you say it's going in a public area, I can give you stuff that consistently gets over 36 or over 40 to be safe. Mm. But you can batch test specific batches of tiles.
So 36 would be for what areas?
That's the problem with the pendulum test. There's no instructions that say what goes where.
Right.
So 36 to 150 is a massive range.
Mm.
I have very smooth R9 tiles that consistently get over 36 on the pendulum. I've had one guy years ago now who tried to put smooth tiles around a swimming pool. And we said, you can't, they're smooth. And he said, but it's plus 36, they're fine. So they really aren't. You have to use common sense. That's why we always do R ratings.
I was going to say, yeah, a lot of people do both, don't they?
Definitely, because the R ratings are sensible. And there's a list of instructions that say, if you're doing this, use that.
So as an interior designer, you would have to make a judgment on that for where you're putting it. And that would be that the onus would be on you, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Really, not on the manufacturer.
It's down to you and your client what you specify.
Yeah.
We can only advise you.
Yeah.
With the case of the guy who wanted smooth tiles around a swimming pool, I refused to supply him.
Really?
But that's about the end. Yeah.
Well, good.
Not
yeah.
Not happen very often, but that was kind of dangerous.
Yeah.
So I can advise you, but ultimately what you put down is up to you and your client. If it's open to the public, you really do need to have plus 36 on the pendulum.
Mm.
But yeah, if it's outside, everything's going to be plus 36. So yeah, you need to have the R ratings as well because they're sensible.
What? Current trends in tile design.
This is such a difficult
patterns, colours and textures.
It's such a difficult one to answer because everyone's views and opinions differ so much. I can tell you that since COVID, I have a theory that during COVID when we were all at home and our homes are lovely and soft and cosy and colourful and they're not grey boxes. So since COVID, we've had a lot more requests for colourful tiles and more natural tones. So terracottas, warmer browns and greens. Yeah, there's lots more biophilic projects happening, people putting plants into their buildings. So green is very popular at the moment and terracotta is really popular.
So we went to the Dulux.
Yeah, you said colour of the year.
I keep saying awards because I did the awards last year. The Dulux launch, the global launch for their colour of the year 2025. And it was called a colour called True Joy, which is very similar to these cushions. So I was quite chuffed because I was like, oh,
you're a trendsetter. You're ahead of
started
the
that. We did that with these. We ordered these cushions for the HRC last year. But yeah, True Joy. And it's a beautiful, fun, uplifting colour. But all the palettes that they did. And if anyone's interested to learn more about this, there's a reel on my social media of the event the other night with the palettes on it. And I'm actually going to ask my rep at Dulux to send me all the little paint pots and just do a little thing on the wall with it. Because the palettes are so different because this colour can be used with other colours of the same tone or it can be used with really earthy colours. It's so versatile.
Absolutely.
And a lot of them were what you've just described, terracotta, really kind of natural colours and things like that.
I mean, not to do ourselves out of sales, but from a sustainability point of view, we always tell people to design for commercial projects or big projects, design neutral.
Mm.
And then when you want colour and warmth, bring that in fabric, furniture, things that can be reupholstered, rugs that can be moved around and replaced.
Mm.
But anything that's permanent and going to stay glued to the walls or the floors, it makes sense to go neutral and inoffensive.
Base.
Yes.
Definitely.
Because a grey floor tile or a white floor tile will go with your True Joy yellow.
True Joy. The event was so inspiring. It was just brilliant.
Lovely.
And what they're saying is that we're taking a leap next year.
Yeah.
Like we've had COVID, we've had all these tough times over the last few years with Brexit and everyone's struggling with the cost of living. Everyone's been quite cautious.
You really do need some True Joy in our lives.
Yeah, and it's like taking a leap, and it's about taking a leap into next year, and actually people are going to start taking more risks and being more bright and bold is the theory. So, yeah, so good.
I mean, I do sell yellow tiles, but...
Yeah, great. We need to see them. We're going to do a little video after this on YouTube about the tiles, because Jo's very lovely. People who can hear this can't see this, but she's sitting next to a really cool board. And Jo is my kind of person because she's done all of these mood boards from the tiles of her range, and they just look brilliant. So I really want to show our following on YouTube. So
we'll do a little video next.
Yes, we're going to do that. So watch out for that. So trends. What else is trendy? We talked about terracotta. I mean, I don't think terracotta is going anywhere. I think, not terracotta, sorry. We talked about terrazzo. I don't think it's going anywhere.
You're right with both, actually. I mean, real terracotta and real terrazzo have been around forever.
Yeah.
They're always going to be around.
I'm sure Tesco's and all the supermarkets use terrazzo.
Yeah, yeah.
On their floors.
And weirdly, we're doing lots of distilleries and wineries using real terracotta.
Mm. We're working on a project called Worsley Park Garden Centre at the moment for their restaurant. It's like a 300-seater restaurant. And I was with Hannah yesterday. We were designing it and she was helping me sort of order fabrics and things. And I was saying, what we're trying to achieve is a base. We're using the patterned fabrics and the stuff that's going to go out of fashion in a few years on cushions. And
which will get worn and therefore need replacing anyway.
Exactly.
Or reupholstering anyway.
Yeah, or they get pinched or whatever. And so in the commercial.
So the base build of the background of the building.
Yeah, so the base of the design is all like browns and greens and dark kind of rich colours.
Yeah.
And then we've got wallpaper on the wall behind the fixed seating, which could be redecorated, for example.
Yeah.
But the redecoration will probably happen way ahead of the reupholstery, you know? So we've used materials on the upholstery that are 100,000 plus rubs, so it looks this like a faux leather that we've used a lot in different tones of different, but it's all very kind of neutral. It's like browns and tans and dark greens and things like that. And then we're going to put the tabletops in. I think it's going to be a tile top.
Okay.
There's one of our suppliers has just started doing a range of tiled tabletops with brass edges. It's awesome.
Yeah,
we're probably going to use something like that. And then like on the chairs, we're going to use like, I think we're going to do pops of colour. So we're going to do 5 or 6 chairs in yellow.
Yes.
We were trying to get yellow into it yesterday. We're like, we've got to get yellow into this scheme. It's like asking for it, especially after finding out about the colour of the year next year.
Yeah.
So we've gone like, I think we've only got 8 chairs in the whole scheme of 300 seats that are bright yellow, but they're going to be standing out. So you might not like those in a few years, but there's only 8 of them, you know? So it's that kind of way of designing, isn't it? That's how to be sustainable.
If it's permanent and stuck down, then neutral is sensible.
Mm.
And bring in the colour in chairs that can be repainted and reupholstered.
I've got some of your tiles in there, haven't I? I've got the green
lovely
tiles I'm going to stack.
Yeah, nice.
Is it called stack bond? Stack?
Yes.
Stack bond, when you put them on top of each other.
Yeah.
Stack bond.
As opposed to staggered.
Love. Sustainable and eco-friendly tile options. What advice have you got around that?
We've kind of covered sustainable design.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if it's glued down, it's more sustainable to be neutral so that it lasts forever. I mean, if you're designing a new building, if you put carpet in one area and tile in another area, in 10 years' time, when someone new comes in, they tend to change but stick with the same type. So if it's carpet first, it always is carpet. every reiteration. And if it's tile, it always stays tile. But if it's going to be stuck down, the most sustainable thing is to keep it as neutral as possible so that it doesn't offend anyone and can stay for as long as possible. When you talk about sustainability in manufacturer, we've obviously got the EPD paperwork now from almost all of our manufacturers. That's what we were going to do. It's going to explain the different types of EPDs to you when we first started talking about it.
Cool.
So this EPD is the Environmental Product Declaration, the identity card of any product. It's quite expensive to do because they're independently assessed. You're looking at between 6 and 10,000 euros to be independently assessed to get an EPD, and it can take a bit of time. But I would urge all designers to audit their suppliers and get as many EPDs as they can.
EPDs,
yeah. Environmental Product Declaration. It will give you the carbon footprint of everything. So if rules come into place, at the moment it's all voluntary to build buildings to maximum carbon footprints per square meter. If it becomes compulsory, then you will need all this. But at the moment it's voluntary, so it's advisable to have all this and try and be as eco-friendly as possible and keep your carbon footprints down. So you get three different types of EPD, and Brianne will give you points depending upon how good your EPD is. A lot of the smaller factories have clubbed together and been assessed as a group, and that's called an industry-wide EPD. So it could be 10 or 20
factories, yeah,
who are all a bit smaller, don't want to fork out all that money, clubbed together. So it does give you useful information. It is a useful thing. It's just not as detailed as some of the others. And then you've got a factory EPD, where the assessors will look at a factory as a whole and all their production lines, which is obviously much more focused and relevant. And then some factories, very few, have forked out to do an EPD for every single range that they do.
Wow.
It's really expensive. But obviously, the most accurate information of all. Generally, tiles have a carbon footprint of about 10 kilograms of carbon per square meter. So that is 10 kilograms of carbon are produced when making a square meter of tiles. That carbon will be hanging around in the atmosphere for 100 years. So we need trees and grasses and seaweeds and things to absorb the carbon dioxide. But we're obviously, as a nation or as a species, producing more carbon than there are enough trees and things to remove, which is why we've got the greenhouse effect. So we need to reduce as much carbon as possible. Some of our factories are doing carbon offsetting. Now, tree planting is great, but you don't plant trees, you plant saplings, and it'll take 10 years before a tree is actually absorbing enough carbon to make it useful. So tree planting offsetting schemes are a bit misleading because they're not going to be offsetting for years and years. Technologies that absorb carbon and sink it and lock it up into the ground so it can't be in the atmosphere. Technologies that take coal-producing power plants out and replace them with wind or solar, that kind of thing. So technological advances that actually do some good. So we do have factories doing lovely things like that. Yeah, we've got sustainable production and sustainable design.
Is there certain ranges in your products that are more sustainable than others?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it does tend to be the bigger factories who have got more money and can afford to do better things. So we work with teeny tiny factories who produce handmade tiles occasionally and produce terracotta tiles and things like that. And they can't be bothered, will not spend the money, will never get an EPD. And then we work with giant, enormous factories who have solar panels on every roof and wind turbines in the car parks. One factory built their own lake, so they don't take water from the local community, got their own water supply, and they are ready, so they don't take it away from the local community. Obviously, water is their...
So do they recycle that water in the same lake? Does it get used and used?
Yes, yeah, and obviously topped up from the rain. But it also means that when they get round to moving over to green hydrogen manufacture, they've got the water there, ready to split it into hydrogen.
So what does green hydrogen manufacturer mean?
So firing at the moment, when you fire tiles, you use fossil fuels, you use gas. So that was obviously an issue with the Russian gas thing. But yeah, they've stabilised supply since then. So it is fossil fuels that fire tiles. If you can take out some of that fossil fuel energy and replace it with hydrogen, that's great. There are different types of hydrogen. Not my area of expertise. But when we talk about green hydrogen, it means the hydrogen's come from water. So it's
water powered.
Yes, yeah. And clever boffins split the atom, then use the hydrogen, and the what's left over is steam, which is obviously inert and not going to cause anything nasty. But hydrogen kilns are different shapes to normal kilns. Hydrogen is odourless and colourless, and if you have a leak, you don't know. So you have to have special storage tanks that are double lined. You have to have sensors everywhere to see if you're leaking it.
It sounds more expensive to do it that way.
Yeah, it's a whole
initially process, like to yeah. set up.
The pipes to move it are different shaped or sized pipes to the pipe you would need to move gas. Everything had to be started from scratch. So very few people have the money and the time and the space to do that. And if you go to Italy, the main tile manufacturing region, and you drive down the street, it is tile factory. That's all there is next to each other. There's no space to expand. The only way to expand is to buy your neighbour and become a big group. So that, you know, that does happen. But yes, people are sort of having to move further out town to get space, start again and build new production plants. It's a huge process.
And how much of the tile industry is doing that? Is what would you say?
A fraction. It's tiny. Yeah. I mean, we have the leading manufacturer moving over to green hydrogen is at about 7% production now. It's a start.
Yeah.
You know, it's absolutely better than nothing. But
yeah. And the tiles coming out of that production line much more expensive than...
No.
Are they not?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. It's not going to change the price of the tiles.
I suppose it's the initial setup, isn't it? It's not the ongoing cost. Yeah, it's the getting the kilns.
If anything, the ongoing cost should be less because water is cheaper than gas.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know. Filter three.
Oh, it's got to, hasn't it? It's got to.
I don't.
Fingers crossed. Fingers crossed. Come on, factories. Get hydrogen. Yeah. Get hydrogen.
But yes, the hydrogen is a great step forward.
Yeah, I think talking to Hannah Temple the other week, she's a member of the Green Party, and she was talking about governments and everything else. And they've had a really successful election. I know that they've only had four people as members of parliament, but the actual percentage of people who voted Green was a real statement to the government to say, look, you really need to do something about this now, because you know, the Green Party might not get into power because they haven't got the seats in each area, but they've upped their percentages so much.
Yeah, it's a really important topic for a lot of people.
Yeah, if we want to carry on living on this planet as human beings, we've got to do something, haven't we, at some point? So practical tips and advice, maintenance tips.
Have you got any maintenance tips
for tiles?
Honestly, the nicest thing about tiles is they're really dense, so they're very unlikely to stain. Because they're fired at such high temperatures, all the raw ingredients that go into them fuse together. It's called vitrification, which is just like glass, basically. It's seamless. All the molecules join together, so you can't get anything into a tile.
Mm.
You can't stain a tile, which means they're really easy to look after. So it's just about finding the right way to clean a tile if you've got it stained. But most tiles, you just clean them with something pH neutral, like Flash XL, if you're at home, that kind of thing, or the commercial equivalent.
So you can use a lot of different detergents and sprays and things. You can't bleach
the tile. You can leave bleach on it. You can leave acid on it. I've seen people, you know, leave tiles in brick acid to see what will happen to them, and they just don't dissolve. They last forever.
Wow.
So, basically, your everyday cleaning and maintenance of tiles is just something pH neutral, inert, water, a bit of detergent if you've got your dirty tiles. But basically, they're really easy to look after. If you are struggling to clean tiles, 99 times out of 100, it's early on in the build process. And it's because there's grout and residue from the adhesive left on the surface of the tiles.
Yes.
And that's, you can scrub it and it looks like it's gone, but if it's still there, it acts like a key and holds onto dirt. So it makes the floor look dirtier.
So I think that's a key thing to look for as an interior designer, isn't it? For once the tiler has been in, to make sure that they've cleaned up the tiles afterwards so you don't have a problem further down the line.
It's called a builder's clean.
Yeah.
So you have to make sure your tiler or your builder does a builder's clean. And with tiles, that means you clean them with an watered down acid solution.
Mm.
And the acid dissolves grout on the surface of the tiles. You can clean the tiles with acid every day and you'd never hurt them. but eventually you'd erode the grout joints, which is why you use something pH neutral. But builder's clean, definitely do that. Get rid of all the grout and builder's muck and adhesive that's on the surface of the tiles and go back to a nice clean tile. And then after that, daily cleaning or whatever, maintenance, it's just something pH neutral, broom, hoover. We don't like mops. Mops no. move dirty water around. Water okay. evaporates, the dirt stays behind.
Broom and hoover.
Yeah.
What about wet? Would you not use a wet something?
If you need to scrub the floors and wash the floors, we recommend the two bucket method. So one bucket of water with your cleaning detergent and a stiff bristled broom, and then a bucket of clean water and a mop to clean it all away.
Great.
It's the scrubbing action.
The two bucket method.
Yeah, it's the scrubbing action of the broom that will activate the cleaning chemicals to lift the dirt off, and then clean mop and water to take it away.
Love that.
Oh, good.
I'm such a cleaner. I love that. I'm going to buy another bucket.
And a stiff bristle.
And a stiff bristle. Uh-oh. She's come out. Sorry. Okay, right. Well, we should be out.
We need to get to the end now, because otherwise we'll just giggle.
So we've talked about types of tiles: ceramic, porcelain, glass, stone, and encaustic. Is that how you say it? Yeah. I said this before.
Encaustic.
Encaustic.
We also talked about terrazzo.
We talked about terrazzo. Yeah. Yes, we did. We talked about the differences between wall tiles, floor tiles, and outdoor tiles. All the slip ratings and how we can specify those, and we just need to be very mindful of making sure we've got the right thing in the right place and not to over specify, because then it could be a problem for cleaning.
Yeah, definitely.
We talked about trends. We talked about sustainable and eco-friendly tiling options and innovation in tile manufacturing. Mm-hmm. We talked about maintenance tips. I didn't know that acid one. I think that's brilliant. I'll look out for that one for the builders. The only thing, I knew what I was going to ask you. Grout. So I've always found after a few years, white grout doesn't stay white. Mm-hmm. What's your recommendations around grout?
Honestly, grout will end up grey. Just use grey grout. you can get white grouts. You can get colourful grouts. But grout is a cementitious product.
It's porous, isn't it?
Porous.
Yeah. Exactly. Can you seal it?
Grout joints are only sort of 2 or 3 millimetres wide generally. Mm. So I have seen a product that it's almost like a pen that you draw a sealant over it. But dear God, that would take days on a special project. So no. Normal cementitious grout is not as porous as it used to be. The new stuff, you're looking at about a 4% porosity. When I started, they were 23% porosity.
Right. So it's got better.
It is a lot better. You can also get epoxy grouts. So when I started doing this, epoxy grouts were horrible, smelly, nasty, difficult to work with. You had to wear a hazmat suit and ventilate the area.
I've got a vision of you in a hazmat suit now.
Oh,
I
don't
tire. I know, but I just say it just kept popped into my head.
Epoxy grouts are easier to work with, but a lot more expensive. You'd only really want them in a swimming pool or in a commercial kitchen. Normal cementitious grout we use everywhere. It is going to absorb water, so it will change colour. The only ways around that are to, I don't know, depends on the project, every 3 years or 10 years, acid wash the floor. Give the whole floor a good clean, like a builder's clean. And that will take the very top layer of the grout off and give you back the colour.
What about bleaching? Can you bleach it?
It won't get rid of the dirt.
Really?
No. If anything, it would dye it yellow.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you'd have to leave bleach on it, onto a white grout, possibly to dye it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what you're going to do.
Okay. Good tip. Thank you.
Yeah. It's basically just dirt, isn't it? You can't bleach.
No. Yeah, absolutely. That was amazing. Thank you so much, Jo. You are such a mindful of knowledge. It's so nice to be with you.
Thank you.
It's amazing. Thank you so much for educating our listeners.
You're very welcome. I'm always here if you have questions, if you need anything.
Thank you so much for being here. So Harvey's joined us. Little monkey. Look, he's got on a proper poodle tail now. Oh, goodness. Have a look on YouTube if you want to see Harvey. He's beautiful. He's just been groomed. Thanks for joining us on the Interior Design Podcast. If you like this episode, please like, share, and leave us a review. We're on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram at interiordesign.podcast and on LinkedIn as Interior Design Podcast. We really value your feedback. If you have any ideas on any topics you'd like us to cover or people you'd like us to interview, please get in touch. The next few podcasts that we've got planned are commercial kitchens, how to design a yoga studio, and we are in talks with Dulux to do a LRV podcast as well. So watch this space. We've got a lot of exciting things coming up, and thank you for tuning in. See you next time.